Crypto hunter John Rhodes has been building bridges of understanding between the reptile amphibian studies and UFOs. Regarded as a pioneer in the UFO community, he's one of the first to investigate and promote the subject of reptoids or reptilians. John has acted as a consultant and appeared on many television shows and recently appeared on the Discovery Channel's Animal X, speaking about the 1988 reptoid or lizard man encounters in Bishopville, South Carolina. John's out-of-the-box perspectives and open-minded scientific viewpoints have made him a very popular public speaker, both nationally and internationally, and he has lectured and held workshops at numerous UFO conferences and will be a featured speaker at Victoria Jack's Bay Area UFO Conference in San Jose, California, in October. My pleasure to introduce you to John Rhodes. Hi, John. How are you? John?
I'm doing great, George.
There
How are you?
You are. Okay. I thought you were in the center of the planet for a moment.
Yeah, it's a long wave that would carry it.
Let's talk. Before we get into reptoids, I want to get a better understanding of things that could be in the center of this planet, because that, I think, will be helpful to all of us in this discussion. Of course, I always like to talk a little bit about what Admiral Richard Byrd did on his trips to the North Pole and the South Pole. You know, in his diary, if it's true, and I want to get your take on that, he tells of entering the hollow interior of the planet along with others, traveling 17 miles over mountains, lakes, rivers, vegetation, animal life. Eventually, he says they were greeted by flying machines of a type that he had never seen before, escorted to a safe landing area where he was graciously greeted by emissaries from another era. And, you know, they told him, hey, you know, you are a man of high standing and moral character. That's why we allowed you to come in. And they were concerned about the atomic bombs at the time. And off the Admiral went again. And then in 56, there's talk that he led an expedition to the South Pole and that he and his crew penetrated 2,300 miles into the center of the planet and that he wrote about seeing a sun and things like this. Is this all true? Is this a myth?
Well, we have to understand that we're talking about many years of belief before the UFO phenomenon fully hit human society as a social issue, that people were talking about the inner Earth at those times. It was their form of discussion of what we would, you know, the fringe were talking about the hollow Earth. When it comes to thinking about what our governments and such might think, we have to remember in 1838, in fact, the U.S. Congress allotted $300,000 to find a pathway to open up a trade route to a civilization that was thought to live far to the north. And you've got to remember, that's not so long ago in history. Not now, of course, if you brought this up before the House, they would just laugh at you. And they might think something different, but they would laugh at you as long as the cameras were on.
Yeah.
As far as Byrd's concerned, we have to remember that some of the stuff about the diary and such of Byrd's diary has been based upon people who have picked up upon what Byrd actually said during the radio transmissions and afterwards, and they may have concocted some sort of lengthy things about how he flew into the Earth and met emissaries and this, that, and the other. And we have to remember that's going to happen no matter what. When you get a good story, somebody's going to embellish it. And I think that's the case in what happened there. However, I have to clarify, when the Nazis surrendered in 1945, several U-boats were unaccounted for. And there were rumors that a secret operation by the name of Paperclip, which we may have heard a lot about in recent history, was actually trying to pursue the top scientists of the German forces as they abandoned there. And they did actually find, I think it was U-boat 530 and U-977, to be specific, were actually found out along the coast of South America. And this whole issue brought up, you know, the boys of Brazil. You know, there was these rumors, of course, after the war, and then, you know, several high-ranking German officers were found down in that area. If the Nazis at that time had really wanted to go somewhere beforehand and set up a base, that would be the appropriate area, because once the Antarctica covers the entire southern part of the planet. From the shores of Antarctica, you could pretty much go anywhere. And those trade routes and those shipping routes have to go around the Cape in those southern areas, and they would be victims of U-boat attacks. So when Byrd went down there, he actually took a fully armed battle group with him. Why? Because they knew that there were some subglacial wolf packs hanging out in there. Wanted to go down and find them to rout out those guys before any of them got any ideas about continuing onto the Fourth Reich. And when he got down there, there were ammunitions taken, there were weapons taken, there was the aircraft. And when he went down beyond that point of where we say he entered the Hollow Earth, he was actually talking about going beyond a certain location. That's what's led everybody to the mystery of what exactly did he mean by going to the land beyond. Because beyond what? If you're 2,300 miles beyond the pole, you're actually on the other side of Antarctica.
Exactly.
And coming to water again. People say
at least you're supposed to be.
At least you're supposed to be. People say it's ridiculous, actually, to think of the Earth being hollow and with big openings down there, but there are very, very few times have there ever been satellite photos that show the North Arctic or the Antarctica completely free of clouds. And people say if there was a hole down there, people haven't fallen into it. They make all the jokes on the TV shows and such.
Well, what they don't know is
about a hole that's 800 miles in diameter.
Yeah,
you're walking up to it. You wouldn't really.
You wouldn't even know you were doing it. It's right. It would be such a small, slight curve.
Right.
You know, it would be almost like when you look at, the end of a sea or something. It looks flat.
Right. You know, and he did make the comment about seeing the great land beyond the sky. And if you were actually going over a region like that, it would be like going over a huge endless hill. You would just see the horizon just slowly and slowly start lifting up above your head.
And if you were flying over it, following the land, you would go right into it.
You would go right into it. Of course, you'd your instruments on board the craft. I'm a pilot. I know that your instruments, when they start getting around anything that's anomalous like that, that there's electromagnetic disturbances that are going to throw your instruments off, and it's going to be hard to navigate. And he was in uncharted territory anyway, so rather than stick around to go any further, he probably made the best and safest choice, which was to return.
Many ancient civilizations philosophically state that there's the region that's inside the planet is called Agartha. And they say that it was first colonized thousands of years ago when a holy man led a tribe to the underground, and that these people had immense scientific knowledge and expertise, and they may be onto something based on your theories when we get into the reptoids in a moment, John. We may be talking about the same thing, but with different beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's not just the reptoids that are living underground. Let me make that quite clear.
Okay.
I'm concentrating on the reptoids, but there are other beings that are living in union with them and quite peacefully. They just can't imagine allowing a bunch of humans underground and mixing all that up.
So this ancient philosophy that the first colonization might have occurred thousands of years ago might be true then.
It might be true, and it would certainly answer a lot of the Genesis origins. The ancient people from around the world, when they talk about how they were first born, they're all talking about coming from underground. And even in the ancient accounts of Genesis, the first two, they were living in caves, and they hadn't seen the sun before. It was a new thing to them. So when you're talking about being cast out of the garden, there's a lot of people in metaphysics and philosophy that believe the garden was actually the interior of the earth, and the exterior is outside, because you have the harshness of weather, you have the beating sun, you have different types of insects and different animal lives you have to worry with. And more so than anything, you also are susceptible to any kind of a climatological or extraterrestrial threat that approaches the planet. I can't stress that enough, that what drives intelligent species underground is a recognition of such a threat and a wish to continue their race and their species beyond any kind of a devastating event.
Do we know what came first, the underground civilization or the above-ground civilization?
Well, that's kind of hard to tell. I mean, it's an area of science that I haven't dwelled that much into, because we're talking about amino acids and such like that. We know now that there's life forms being found called extremophiles, and they're called extremophiles because they're found in extreme environments deep under the ground, also deep under the ocean near volcanic events, and they're living and existing quite nicely in a atmosphere and in a in a situation that would be deadly to most other animal life. So when we think about where creatures could live, we just cannot, you know, think within the parallel lines that we've established for ourselves as far as our vision of what could be and what couldn't be underground.
John, do you think governments are aware of all this?
I believe this is one of the biggest secrets that there has ever been. And I also believe that that there has been an effort on behalf of military-industrial corporate complex industries to continue our pointing to outer space in search for answers about aliens or extraterrestrials, when in fact we should be searching under our very feet for those same creatures or people that are coming from far off our planet. They wouldn't turn around and go back on a day trip. They would leave somebody here, or they would park their craft under some underground somewhere. And if there are creatures that have existed on Earth long before we ever were even sentient beings, then the underground seems like the natural place to actually be and allow a civilization to grow up from its genesis without knowledge of your presence.
What I find so fascinating is so much of this ancient culture and historians and authors and people who have written about that, some of it, of course, being fiction, but they all seem to think that there's something going on in there, in the center of the planet. And that, to me, is a pretty astounding theory.
Well, remember that the center of the planet itself is a theory. Nobody has yet actually sent anything physical down to obtain any physical evidence that any of these theories or hypotheses based on blackboards by men who push their eyeglasses up towards the bridge of their nose and live by a pencil sharpener, that their opinion is any better than any one of ours. There have been some great breakthroughs in human histories by people with no educations, and so it should not be underestimated the intelligence of the average person to think and discover the truth beyond that of anybody that's being paid, you know, in government grants to keep their mouth shut.
Is the existence of a hollow earth or subterranean earth important in your reptoid theory?
It is, in as much as when you start recognizing that there's so much in antiquity to indicate that there was some sort of a reptilian presence on our planet, not only just physically, but also it's been turned into a philosophy, almost a religion, because there's so much of human psychology mixed in with the reptilian part of our brains and how we're identifying with this subject that it's going to take some time to blow. But one of these days, we're all going to suddenly wake up and find out we've all been had, and we've been looking in the opposite direction of where we should have been.
And it was right under our nose.
It was under our feet. They say the best place to hide something is right in front of us.
That's true, right under your feet, literally. John, tell me a little bit about you and how you got involved in this.
Well, I got involved in this a number of years ago. I was working as a professional actor in New York City, much like all the other people who kind of get out of that profession and end up doing other things. I mean, the Pope Paul, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, all these guys, Sean David Morton. I started looking into this issue when I was watching TV one night, and I started hearing about the Roswell case. And Glenn Dennis, who is the mortician in Roswell, New Mexico, when the craft supposedly crashed there, had said that the nurse that he knew actually drew a illustration of what the creature's hand looked like. And when she described it, and you look at this, we're talking about these circular pads on their fingertips. And for somebody like myself who is interested in reptiles and amphibians and such, I recognize that as an earmark of a reptilian physical construct. In tree lizards, they have these little circular pads on their fingertips that have microscopic barbs in them, and they look like suction pads, but they're actually used to hold on to smooth surfaces. And so when I heard that, in as much as what its hand looked like, and then Wendell Stevens and other people had written about how this creature had beaded skin like a lizard, the two things were just grabbed me, and I suddenly realized why it's why the UFO community has been concentrating on the physical evidence of the crash itself and being steered away from this phenomenal description of what this creature looked like.
I love your theory, by the way. You know, I've gone through a lot, and I mean, this is just exciting. You know, tomorrow I've got a roundtable discussion, John, called God, Man, and E.T. with,
yes, I heard,
with Richard Hoagland and Michael Heiser and Hugh Ross. And it's just something I've been looking forward to a long time. But you are, and David Flynn, by the way, you are as exciting to talk about with this theory, because there aren't a lot of people who do this. And, I mean, it makes you wonder just what the heck's going on this planet, because it mixes what I really like, and that's real science with the possibilities of something that could be very paranormal.
Right. You know, and when you're talking about this, you're also talking about how artists and people like that throughout history have been used as vehicles for promoting a future technology to audiences. Jules Verne, all the great ones, Arthur C. Clarke. I loved Arthur C. Clarke, as we'll discuss later. Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book, Childhood's End, and we'll discuss that later during the show, and I'll come back to it because it's a nice build-up to it, because actually there is evidence all around us that we are being prepared for eventual contact with some sort of a threat from off this planet in order to bring down all international borders and unite all humanity, and the threat will be posed in some sort of a physical form that actually we are highly reactive to because of 2,000 years of indoctrination by religions and such in the Western world, that when something like this arrives, we will be armed and ready before we even ask questions, which is something I'm not looking forward to, but I have a feeling that we're headed towards that.
Maybe sooner than you think, John.
It might be. Some people have targeted 2012 because it was the end of the Mayan calendar. Tonight, for the first time, I'm going to also be discussing, at a little bit of length, not in great length, the connections between England, where the crop circles are happening, and Mexico City, where the UFO activity has been increasing since 1991.
Well, when we come back, we will find out John's take on just what a reptoid is. We'll also talk a little bit about that 1988 lizard man encounter in Bishopville, South Carolina, that he's got a lot of knowledge of. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, my favorite newsletter magazine is called the After Dark Newsletter. I write a column for it every month, and it's got all kinds of fascinating stories tied directly into Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about Dr. Morgus in the July issue, as well as Zero Point Energy and a number of other issues. If you don't have this as a subscription, well, what are you waiting for? A couple ways to do it. Toll free. You don't need a computer. You can just call this number, 1-888-727-5505. 1-888-727-5505. The other way, of course, is to go to the coasttocoastam.com website, click through the orange type to that secure server, and get your 14 issues for the price of 12. And also, Lex tells me that there's also another easy way to link right up to Coast. It was a secret, and Lex, of course, has told it to us because we forced him to. It's CTOC. That's it. CTOC.com. It's simple as that. And that'll get you right to the coasttocoastam.com website, too. So a lot of ways to get there. And welcome to Coast. I'm George Norrie. John Rhodes, my guest. John, tell me a little bit about the Reptoids Research Center.
We established the Reptoids Research Center back, got it on the internet in 1997. And it was actually established after I was already speaking on speaking circuits and trying to turn everybody's head around at some of the UFO conventions to look in an opposite direction. I had been doing that for a number of years before. It was kind of difficult to get everybody to, you know, to think of a different perspective. But we opened the research center up, and over the last years, we've been going around and interviewing people who claim to have had contact with these beings. The most impressive thing I've noticed is that some of these people don't even really want to talk about it because they're bothered by the subject. Hmm. They don't want any, they wished it had never happened. They don't want to write books. And these are the type of people that I feel are good candidates for people who are actually talking about a real event rather than something that might be fictitious in order to get on stage or, you know, just to have people listen to them. And when I started recognizing that some of these people were people in established authority here in the United States, for gosh sakes, you know, we have people from all different walks of life having seen a creature like this and reporting it and nobody wanting to listen to them. And as with the center, we've been actually able to go down there, talk to those individuals, review the given circumstances of the area, look for the physical or trace evidence that might be there. We do character profiles on everybody. We try and see if there's a reason that these people might be lying. On occasions, we've actually hooked up cameras without their knowing it on location and seen people, you know, plant evidence to make it look like something was there. So they were trying to fool us. And that's the great use of trail cameras, because you don't have to be there to take a snapshot. And what's really interesting is that a lot of these people really do believe they saw something. And it, and in many cases, it has psychologically been torturous for them because they've had to adjust their life after.
Yeah, it has been life-changing. It's been dramatically life-changing for a lot of these people, hasn't
exactly.
it,
exactly, and especially not only when you encounter something humanoid that may or may not have stepped out of a craft or cave, but when you see something with scales and vertical slit pupils that's standing there perhaps 7.5 feet tall like a linebacker, it's so intimidating that many people instantly feel that they're having some sort of a paranormal or demonic event because of what we've been told for over 2,000 years and what some people still try and use today, the fear of the serpent image that's ingrained in us from this indoctrination, to stand toe to claw with something like that is very difficult to overcome and get used to. A lot of people, their lives have been disrupted. And when people say, well, I want to be hypnotized because I want to find out what happened, I'm often one to say, are you sure? Because we might have we might have voluntary, you know, or involuntary amnesia on this because we don't really believe that we could adjust it to our real lives. And just as the housewife would ignore the lipstick on her husband's collar, we'll ignore something even though it's standing directly in front of us if it means that that's the only way to maintain our sanity. And these creatures are imposing. When they have contact with people, there's a more of a psychic connection that's taking place than anything that's speech. In some occasions, you know, these beings have been seen to be diminutive and small, like the grays. On other times, they've been seen to, in their variations, some have wings. They're called the Draco. And the Draco are the classical image of Satan. And it's almost interesting to think of how that image could be adapted.
Like a fallen angel, maybe, John?
Like a fallen angel, yeah. But, you know, anytime something's demonized, the reason, you know, why the Satan image a long time ago was even given a crooked nose is because somebody decided they didn't like people with crooked noses, so they were going to attach it to the character and then promote that forever after. So, you know, that's part of the indoctrination. But when you're looking at something like that, and it's actually occurring in front of you, I think that
well, it scares the heck out of you. That's
well,
what it does.
Yeah, and, you know, even though I've been investigating this for this many years, I've seen the genuine sincerity of some of these contactees. Not all of them, I would say, but maybe 85% of them are. There's something amiss in their story, and there's something not connecting.
That's a huge percent. Okay, let's get into the specifics, John, for a moment on what you think these reptoids are. First of all.
Well, personally, I believe that life is diverse on our planet. We know that we've uncovered perhaps 2.5% of all life on Earth we have cataloged, and scientists actually recognize these creatures. That means that there are an additional 97.5% we have not yet come in contact with. And some of these creatures can be quite large, as we've seen recently. And, God, everybody's mind was blown when they discovered, you know, the hobbits. Because we just weren't expecting that.
Right.
And these creatures or beings may have actually been, like the birds many millions of years ago, evolved from dinosaur survivors. Some of the dinosaurs actually survived to become birds. They actually miniaturized themselves and morphologically changed over time because of radiations and different types of mutations and such like this to become birds. And it took us this long to even recognize that. That some of these beings or creatures may have been pre-adapted to an underground life perhaps down even in Antarctica, where dinosaurs did live at one time. And because of the extreme colds and the darkness, these creatures would have sought the underground during the summer months so they could live in darkness, because their eyes were specifically being adapted to a dark environment. And in order to get warm, they'd also want to get out of the cold. And there's a lot of ancient volcano systems that are inactive down there that creatures could have retreated into. You got to remember, it's the nature of a serpent or a reptile to go underground. So this is a natural draw.
I mean, did they have arms and legs, or did they crawl around?
No, at that time, I believe that they were more like a traditional dinosaur.
Okay.
It was like a troodont dinosaur, which is upright. It stands. It was standing about 4 to 5 feet tall. The creature had opposable thumbs. Its eyes had slowly over time started to come forward to be more of a stereoscopic view, so you could actually see in stereo, so you can be a better predator.
Did it have a tail?
It had a tail, absolutely, and lipless mouth, ears that, you know, weren't, no ears, flat sides to the head and such. And that these creatures, during the devastation that wiped out their northern cousins, as it got colder and colder and more inhospitable, I believe that they may have actually retreated into the underground. And over millions of years could have adapted to large underground tunnels and caverns that are deep under the earth. And if, without solar radiations beating down on them, their genetics would allow them to mutate along a more natural design. And over millions of years, I believe that they may have become these humanoid beings. My belief is not totally unsupported. There is a scientist by the name of Dale Russell, and Dale Russell had been working with the Canadian Museum of Nature up in Ottawa, Canada, and he actually worked with another colleague of his named Ron Seguin. They came up with a model of something that looked like a humanoid dinosaur after they had taken the troodont dinosaur, which was known as Stenonychosaurus inequalis, if you want to say that real fast after a couple drinks. And they said, what would this creature have looked like if it had been allowed to evolve and not died off? And based on all the scientific principles of trends of physiological and physical trends the creature had shown in its history, they extrapolated that forward, and they came out with a model that was of a humanoid reptile, very much like what the ancients have been talking about and what modern-day men and women, some of our own brothers, sisters, friends, and neighbors who are never talking about it, have encountered these creatures. And so if there's an ounce of possibility that dinosaurs did survive the devastation 65 million years ago to become birds, then just perhaps these other creatures are the root of all the anthropomorphic or humanoid reptilian deities that have been reported throughout histories. And they have been deified not only because of their advanced knowledge and wisdom, but also because we psychologically attach to the serpent image if we can get past the natural revulsion of it, because it may be part of our own genetic memory that's holding the image up like a mirror.
Well, you know, they say beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And,
exactly.
And these images you sent us that we've got linked up with your website, reptoids.com, on coasttocoastam.com. There's one image here that we've got on our homepage you gave us, John, about looks like a human on a table on some kind of exam. And these creatures are ugly. I'll give you that.
Well, you know, I guess you just have to get past it. If it looks like these creatures might be there, we just have to get past it. And if we don't, then we're really just facing our own darkness inside us. Because if we can't get past us, then who are we to believe that we belong in an environment or society deep underground with many different types of various life forms that look very, very different and frightening, perhaps?
At what point, then, in their evolution, did the brain start to change? Because they weren't always as intelligent as they are now, apparently, right?
Well, we can only assume given natural course of nature that, you know, intelligence is something gained over long periods of time through different mutations and information being passed through the eyes and the ears and the skin down to our sensory input being put back to our brain and our brain translating it down to a genetic level and impregnating it in that DNA. Actual memory impregnated into that DNA, not only memory of physical types, but perhaps perceptual things. And if we're talking about how does a creature identify a poisonous plant when it's never eaten it before and nobody ever taught it?
Good point.
It's because there's some inherent intuition, we call it. Intuition. It's a genetic thing that tells you don't eat that plant.
How do they know not to jump off the edge of a cliff?
Well, everybody does but the lemmings.
Yeah.
And we can't figure them out.
Yeah.
We can't figure them out. But then why does human society allow the continuance of a war-making economy, a global war-making economy, with being told that they're really seeking peace when it actually is against the economic sense to seek peace when you create weapons of war? How can we allow that to continue? Also, why are we so self-destructive as a human species without standing up saying enough is enough?
Is it the nature? How many of these creatures do you think are underneath in the hollow portion of the planet?
Well, that's hard to determine, George. We're talking about, reservedly, zoologists estimate there's probably about 100 to 125 million life forms that have not yet made contact with humans.
On this planet.
On this planet. We know so little about life on this planet, it doesn't make sense for us to be staring out into space for very few people who ever get the time to sit at those telescopes, staring off into space into some far-outreached, you know, universe when we should be turning our eyes towards our own planet and figuring out how are we going to solve climate change? How are we going to come? Can we reach out into our planet to see if there are other aliens even here that may have survived as perhaps castaways or something like that, or even visitors that could give us the answers or help us to rectify the problem.
Do you think these reptoids developed on this planet, as you've pointed out, or is it possible they came here from above and they just stayed?
I believe that this was originally their planet, and that humans were later
popped in
as perhaps castaways, like I said,
mm-hmm.
maybe from a nearby planet that became inhospitable or blew up and became an asteroid belt or something like that, and that's why they were the caretakers of the garden originally, and then we have these new beings coming down, and they're supposed to be sharing, and they perhaps had difficulty with that. So it's the whole issue of, you know, of the Adam and Eve of various cultures, going all the way back to the Hopi Indians, to the Navajo Indians, to the Tibetans, to the Greeks, to all the Egyptians. If you look around the world, you'll never see any one image other than a bird being presented as a religious form.
True.
In all these different countries. Why is it that human beings became so psychologically attached to this image? And so we're talking about creatures that may actually have evolved here, if I may use that word, and over a given period of time, they have lived parallel to ourselves in a parallel society deep underground. My personal belief at this point, after all these years of looking into this, is that their society may be being held hostage to their own social progress, as well as our own, by individuals, both alien and human, who are profiting off of aggression and off of fear. And it may be that our leaders and their leaders entertain a fear between the two species simply because they just don't want there to be peace, because there's no profit in peace and there's no control without fear,
now,
they believe.
How often, if they're there, do they come to the surface, if at all?
Well, if you put your ear to the rail in the UFO community, you're going to hear a large train coming. And I'm telling you that everybody is starting to turn around and talk about reptoids. It's because we went through these various stages of indoctrination or desensitization to the off-worlders or other-than-human creatures or beings. We had the Space Brothers of the 50s and 60s. We had the Greys pop up, and then they didn't mean anything to us anymore. It wasn't that frightening of image. And now we have an approaching We have an approaching symbol that's about to be entertained in our near future at a time when chaos and war and all kinds of different types of devastations may be actually ruling the planet. And, of course, this fits right in with the apocalypse or Revelation when they talk about the end of the world and the return of the dragon. Because as you may have been already aware of, because you sound quite schooled in this area, George, is that in the great books, it's usually we start with the serpent, and in the end, we end with a dragon or a serpent. And it's kind of like the Ouroboros, the symbol of the serpent with a tail its tail in its mouth.
One would One would assume, then, that these reptoids may not be too friendly.
Some of them are not friendly, just as there are some humans that I would not want to entertain a night out with at the movies or something.
That's true.
This polarity is not... You can't say something looks like this, so it is this. That's been our danger since we've been early man. People, if you suddenly don't want people to like the Japanese, like in World War II, all of a sudden all the magazines and newspapers, they are showing them as little demonic little creatures. I mean, it was really derogatory. So, you know, we have to be careful of how that image is presented to us. And if somebody's presenting them as all evil, that person should be looked at as a possible vehicle for this continuance of fear and control over us.
Do you think, we're coming up to the top of the hour very quickly, John, are they shapeshifters as well, or are they just pure reptoids?
No, I believe some of them may be using technologies that can actually affect the atomic mass of the cell structures of their bodies to move them in and out of phase shift with our visible and detectable reality.
We're going to talk a little bit of Arthur C. Clarke and his work that you just mentioned, Childhood End. We'll also talk about some of the things David Icke has talked about, because he talked about the reptilians as well. And let's find out where you think they are exactly on this planet. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. Our guest is John Rhodes. His website is reptoids.com. It's linked up. Don't have to worry about spelling it right now. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back, Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, John Rhodes, I guess. John, let's talk a little bit more about their physical form and then get into where they may be. Now, they are very close to humans in that they have, what, two arms, two legs, a head?
The general form as a human being does, two arms, two legs, a head, eyes in the same place, face generally looking the same. Some of the structures differ in the face. For example, you wouldn't see any eyebrows on these creatures or eyelashes. There are no lips. It's pretty much little scutes or scales that are wrapped tightly around a ridge that forms a line across their mouth. No ears, perhaps a small scale or flap actually laying right alongside the skull. Eyes that are almond-shaped and wrap around the sides a little bit of their head.
Mm-hmm.
Pupils that have vertical slits in them, often referred to historically as the flame-like pupils. They also have, they're very broad-chested. These are the general reptoids that we're talking about, the ones that people have seen most. Broad-chested, strong arms, very lean bodies. For the males, they've been seen actually wearing outfits, perhaps trying to disguise themselves as humans at a distance.
Interesting.
Otherwise, they have actually been seen without any clothes on, and with the males, you can't see any outside genitalia because it's wrapped within a cloaca, which is a sack. It's like a pouch. And
how about digits on hands and feet?
Digits, you got three digits with an opposable thumb. The nails are usually more toward like a dog's than anything that's been popularly described as long and sharp and hooked, and that just sounds really scary. But for the most part, we've come down to seeing the patterns revealed that they're more of a dog-like claw. Their feet also are like regular human feet. However, they've got a fourth kind of like a thumb or a digit that's wrapped around halfway back up their ankle that's on the opposite side. So we're talking about beings that are physically imposing. We're also talking about some of them have been seen to be quite wild and reported as being more animal-like than anything. The chupacabra is an example of that. People say that they see scales on this creature, but at the same time, hair-like structures. Well, if you study anything about keratin and how even hair came about in the mammal world, you'll discover that it's all from the same keratin growth, and then eventually over time it elongated from a scale out to a long structure of hair that was hollow and allowed for more thermal protection against the body. So we're talking about its hair and scales are not so different as people would really think. So some of these creatures have looked like they've been hairy. Some of them have actually quills. Some have been seen with quills under their chin, which reported looking like they had a beard. And then there are the Draco, of course, which I mentioned before. These are brownish, green beings with the same physical construct as one of the regular reptoids that I just described. However, they have large wings on their backs that are made of a leathery-like skin. And sometimes when people have seen them at a distance, they look like clothes.
There was an old
over their shoulders.
There was a movie with Dennis Quaid that, and I think they called the reptilian alien a Drac or something like that.
Drac from Draco.
Drake, that's right, exactly.
And of course, you know, all of this is historical context, which television shows like Stargate has used to promote the entire philosophy of the show, this evil reptilian thing. And as you can see in modern media now, we've been inundated with the dragon images from Steven Spielberg and all these guys, and now we're seeing an emergence of humanoid reptilian characters coming up in science fiction and films. As a matter of fact, NBC is getting ready to remake V into a 2 or 3 hour miniseries.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
It's just been tagged. So that's why I'm saying everybody's got to understand that this is the next step in the human awareness of what exactly is going on in this planet.
Why are all the reptilians in the media presented as evil?
Well, it's because it's actually using 2,000 years of indoctrination. So something's already been set in its path to help them do it, to help people produce fear. And, you know, fear promotes things to be sold. Everybody loves to be scared. They go to the movie theaters all the time.
Sure. That's also why, control.
Right. And that's why people who present these beings as nothing but, I mean, they'll have perhaps one or two detractors that say, I mean, not detractors, but they'll have one or two lines in a presentation that says they're not all bad, but the only ones that are concentrated on and being presented to the public are being told that they're manipulative, they're in charge of our leaders, they're doing this, that, and the other. And to me, it seems to me that if there is really a global neighborhood out there of other species that are living underground, and we want to be part of that neighborhood, then I would think that as wise as they might be by now, they may be expecting us one day to wake up and take responsibility for the ills of our own planet instead of trying to brush them off on some unseen creatures that somebody is saying is, you know, it's a witch hunt beginning.
Well, going back to Byrd, Admiral Byrd, again, one of the reasons why they wanted to talk to him, if they did, was because they were concerned about what we were doing to the planet.
Right, because why would something off our planet be so concerned about our planet? If they had a hands-off policy, that would mean that they wouldn't be concerned about the planet. But it seems to me that every time, you know, we hear about abductions and such like that, the real cases, that 4 to 5% of cases, that just can't be rocked. You always have these people coming away feeling a little bit more eco-sensitive. And it seems to me that if they're from this planet and there's a trickle-down, in other words, if we destroy the surface and start a chain collapse, it's going to affect the food chain.
Well, now, tell me, though, what under what auspices did a lot of these people who have given the information to allow you to describe what they look like, under what auspices did they come in contact with these reptoids?
There have been many cases in which people in the privacy of their own bedroom have actually entertained a contact. And I say entertained a contact because it's difficult to tell because of human psychology. This is the great thing about, and I hope you discuss it on tomorrow's show, is the root of human consciousness is seated in the ancient part of our brain. This part of our brain is neuroanatomist Paul McLean, who is a very important person in the scientific circles in the government, had said that it was the reptilian part of our brain. I think you've heard David pick up on this. I mean, years ago I had been talking about it, and it's become more and more known about. The ancient part of our brain, if you look back on how we develop from the fetus and we go through these ontological stages where we reproduce kind of like an evolutionary movie basically in the womb. And we even have a tail at one point. We have gill clefts like a fish. We have all these things. Even, and later on, we lose these before we're born. Sometimes we don't entirely lose them. That's why people are born with a caudal appendage, which is actually an extension of your backbone into a tail. There have been cases in which people in third world countries who cannot afford the risk or the money to have these surgically removed at birth are seen as tribal totems. And they don't show them to outsiders because the outsiders would freak out. But some of these people are walking around with tails, and some of them actually have hair on them. And they have been known to actually, when a person gets excited, that tail does involuntarily move, just like a dog would. You know, that sounds so strange, but you know what? I think it's been said, you know, there's greater strangeness in truth than there are in any fantasy, you know, because we're talking about something that's a biological fact. Human beings sometimes are born with a skin condition called ichthyo vulgaris, which means that their skin starts to become like scales.
Yeah, it's scaly skin, exactly.
Absolutely, and they mold. And I've seen entire patches, like a glove, actually taken off a person's hand and been there just like you were looking at a glove, just like a snake was molting.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
So the God question comes in, or the human psychological associations with what God is all about. When you're talking about the human brain and its antiquity and how it's rooted to that reptile that we were all a long time ago and how that drives our subconscious anatomic functions of our body and the constructs of the brain being three-part. You have the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain. This hindbrain belongs to the reptile. So if you're promoting something as evil all the time, what you're really doing is you're telling people to fear something that they have nagging them literally in the back of their mind as a form of self-identification, and they can't figure that out, and it becomes confusing to them. A
friend of mine wants to write a book based on the premise, John, that the devil was not evil. The devil was good in that he was misunderstood. And I told him, I don't know if that would sell. You know, that's pretty revolutionary.
It's pretty revolutionary, but I can't remember the text offhand. I'm looking at my wife wondering if I got my notes here. But there is actually a passage in the Bible that, in which God says, I created all things. I created evil. And some people just cannot get past that passage, because they can't figure out why would God create something that supposedly is anti-God. Perhaps it's because you have a positive and a negative polarity about us.
You have to have that.
Right, and if we are like gods, like we were told in that garden, or gods talked amongst themselves and said, oh my gosh, look, they've become like one of us. Perhaps that duality is something that's inherited, it's a reflection of the above and below thing.
Now, these reptoids, if they're around, where might they be then? You believe most of them are within the planet, but North Pole, Antarctica, whereabouts?
Yeah, I think that we might find first fossil evidence down in Antarctica underneath the ice pack, maybe if we can get through the 3 or 4 miles of ice. Of course, that might just be melted away soon, revealing all
true.
Kinds of things.
You don't have to worry about busting.
Right. Nobody has to take a bulldozer up there. That you can find, I believe that there's heavy concentrations of these creatures now in the American desert southwest, across the 37th parallel of the United States, which is almost the only continuous line running across the United States, which I also suspect there is a black operations or a black world tube shuttle program down there. If you go to my website at reptoids.com, I actually have a link on there where you can see the 1972 LA Times article interview with the lead physicist of the RAND Corporation, who talks about the construction of a hyperspeed tube shuttle under the United States, and said at that time it was economically and technologically feasible to move a person from coast to coast in 20 minutes at 10,000 miles an hour.
Oh, my God. And you think we have that?
I believe that we do. I believe that because the technology was so feasible
and not
so
for
economical,
us.
Why not hook up all our – now, I'm treading on a dangerous area because we're at a state of war right now, so I got to be careful what I say. I don't, you know, the War Act is in effect now, so I don't want to give away too much information. I used to give away a lot more, let's put it that way. And because of the sensitivity of underground issues attached to security and national.
Well, all right, don't give us too much.
No. So I believe that there's an underground network across our nation of underground facilities that are beyond human imagination, that were started back in 1950s by the Truman administration, In 1951, we had 120 ships and about 10,000 men invade Thule in the northern subarctic, and this was to supposedly spy on Soviet detonations of atomic tests, when in fact, or a possible fact, it could be a follow-up to why James Doolittle was sent through the Exxon Corporation up to Norway and Sweden to look into the incidents of the Foo Fighters that were seen around that northern Arctic region.
Yep.
And that after we invaded Thule, the next year we had the sightings over the White House that many people forget.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there was a demonstration of air superiority over the
52, right?
1952,
yeah.
A demonstration of air superiority over the most sensitive air corridor in the world, or in the United States, if not the world. And then after that, in 1953, we had the development of the National Security Agency with the Intelligence Corps and Communications. We had a massive push of building underground structures that FEMA, since the 1980s, has been in charge of to actually prepare the United States for Armageddon. And if we're being told now, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm doing this as a patriot because I feel that we all have to be reminded that in the 1950s, when our parents or grandparents were being shown duck and cover drills because of any kind of a natural disaster, when we're being told now that that's right at our doorstep, I'm wondering why we're not being encouraged to prepare the very same way.
Well, we don't have those shelters anymore.
Well, a huge industry could be built on that, George.
Well, that's true.
You could be, you know, a huge industry could turn around and be built on that. And so
maybe it's like through the looking glass. It's not exactly as it appears.
It's not exactly as it appears, and nothing really is. I learned it some time ago from a good friend of mine that when you look at the UFO phenomenon or any of the things with ghosts and fairies or anything else like that, if you just turn it upside down and attach it to the underworld and what could be possibly happening underground, it all starts to make sense. It all starts to fit in. I believe that we've been misdirected into outer space to keep us from actually attaching ourselves to the true vision of really where these beings are. And that is underground. And that is more technologically achievable to find such creatures on our own planet rather than it is staring off into some space into an endless number of stars and planets.
Well, now, let's talk about their technology. Do you think these reptoids have UFO capability or flying saucer capability?
Yes, I do. You start thinking about how concentric ring circles and circles themselves with the ancients were many times identified with serpent worship, and the circular structures and the circular type of ritual centers that were built a long time ago were associated with the serpent symbol. And then you look at from the ground and you look up to the saucer, a saucer shape, a classical saucer shape, of course you'd see a circle. And this could have been the same thing with circles within circles of Ezekiel. But I believe that they may have actually by now mastered, which we're starting to, actually manipulating atomic matter down to a plasma state and able to move things, shift things from one phase state to another. The UFO technology, my own personal take on this real quick, is the floating frog effect. When in Norway these guys took an electromagnetic generator and put inanimate objects and even a frog into it, they were able to make the electron become unstable around the atomic nucleus, and when they did that, the frog or the inanimate objects lost their mass and floated in the air. And so if you have no mass, this means that if you could have a machine that does that, that loops in on itself and makes even the parts of the generator become plasma or out of phase, and those electrons are knocked off their orbit, that will also float. And if you lose your mass, then you have the ability to move from one location to another without inertia or without G-force, because they all take mass into consideration in those formulas. Once you get rid of mass, all of a sudden you recognize, hey, I'm just a plasma state, I'm just out of phase state, but I'm still together enough to be maybe like an astral body. And then all of a sudden we can just zap our energies like through a line from one location to another, and we would hardly feel it, but we would be there. I have a feeling that that might be the technological aspect.
Well, they're way ahead of us then, Sean.
Well, I think that we have it. And when you're talking about reptilian technology, you're talking about perhaps using brains that don't even think like mammals. So what they would think about or how they would perceive technology would be different from ours because of the perceptions.
Go ahead.
Their technology may be perceived as being more advanced when really it may be equally as advanced, but just working on a different set of dynamic principles of physics.
All right. When we come back, let's talk about that connection you said between Arizona and Mexico, and we'll also talk about Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End. This was a fascinating novel, by the way, that he published in 1953, and then another version was released in 2001, of all years, that deals with the transformation of humanity into part of an interplanetary hive mind. So we're going to get John Rhodes' take on that, because this book opens up with enormous alien spaceships appearing one day over Earth. It's a great, great story. And we'll just simply get your take on that, John, and we'll talk about some other things. At the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone line, so that'll be in about 30 minutes or so, where you can ask John Rhodes a question about some of the things we're talking about. Much more to go right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. John, let's talk a little bit about the Arizona-Mexico tie-in with some of your work.
One of the things that I started to notice was that looking at the history of ancient England and the Celts over in that area of the world, the influence of the serpent image involved in their religion. You know, they talk about St. Patrick having gone to Ireland to rid them of snakes. Well, really, they didn't have a physical snake problem. They had a spiritual snake problem, which was that the locals there, the Celts, were very much into the serpent worship. Their symbolism is inundated with serpent worship. One of the great goddesses was half human, and the lower half was all serpent, and that was one of the big sacred secrets in the groves that were whispered around. So we have a concentration of area of England and Wales and Ireland, heavily dominated by Rh-negative blood types today, having been descendants from those earlier peoples. But this area of Stonehenge and such, with the dominant theme of the serpent symbol in their religions, when you also look at the crop circles are happening there. We have the activity in Mexico City since 1991 during the solar eclipse, which again is another. These creatures, I don't believe, are making moves without trying to tell us something. And when they appeared during the solar eclipse, and since that time in 1991, more and more ships have been seen there. I've recently seen video of tens of, I would say about 100 ships or somewhere around there that were actually flying around Mexico in these formations.
100 of them?
Right. I know that we've seen the Children of the Sun video, which shows like 30 or 40 of them in the sky, and apparently they're becoming more dominant and becoming more of a force down there than ever before. And when you think about that happening in Mexico, and then looking back at the mythology of ancient Mexico and how it was tied to the deity of Quetzalcoatl, which was the feathered serpent, here was somebody that came along who taught them supposedly how to look at the stars, all their mm-hmm. technology, agriculture. He was very, very, very wise being. And the mythology of Quetzalcoatl was that when he left, he said, I will be returning one day to return the empire, the Mayan Empire, back to its former state.
By the way, don't get hit by a train. I hear a train in the background.
No, I'm not on the tracks. You know?
No, get back off that, John. You're doing well.
Putting the ear to the track of the UFO community. Anyway, so when you start seeing this, again, heavy serpent symbolism down in that region of the world and this prophecy, and then you hear, you see this connection of what's happening down there. Now, I think it was 1994, 1995, I went down to Mexico City at the first international UFO conference, and I gave a speech there, and it was a very, very large audience at the medical center there, in which I told people that what we might be looking above Mexico City at are the descendants of the Maya, who may have been themselves castaways of some empire that had collapsed or had sank under the ocean, and that they may be coming out in force now in expectation of something coming here to arrive there. It's not U.S. craft. We don't have any military reason to be down there flying vehicles like that. They don't even have radars that have the same equivalent power or technology as to other nations that we might go to war with. So you have to wonder, why are they down there? Why were the British military personnel caught down there sneaking into the country and exploring their caves of Mexico without passports, which was quite an incident a couple of years ago. Do you remember that?
Yes, I sure do.
So why was the British military exploring the underground there? Bonnie Crystal, who is a friend of arts and mine. She appeared on a television show with me, and the reason I had her brought back on the show, I mean, brought on the show, was because she was exploring a cave a number of years ago called La Cava del Arroyo, which means the Cave of Gold, with colleagues of hers, and they were down about four levels deep, four lengths of the rope deep, which is about 400 feet deep. They crossed a 75-foot underground river, and they came up upon a muddy bank, and inside, on the muddy bank, were imprints of what she described as a bipedal lizard. It was not dragging its stomach. It was not dragging a tail. It had a little bit of a wide stance to it, but it was definitely walking on 2 feet underground.
Tell me about Lizard Man.
The Lizard Man. In 1988, in Bishopville, South Carolina, a young boy at about 17 years old named Christopher Davis was driving home one night, and he stopped to fix a flat tire along a place called Skateboard Swamp. And when he was fixing this tire out there, the poor boy, in the middle of the night, out of the field, he heard a rustling, and it was a hot night. And he just looked around, and he didn't think anything of it, and he went back to work. But then he heard it again, and from a field across the street, he looked up to see something that was like what he described as a lizard man running towards him at full gait.
And there was nobody else around,
And he put himself in the vehicle. He tried to drive down the street, and he said this thing reached out and jumped on the top of his car, trying to reach around to the front of the glass and pull on the antenna and stuff. And he got back home. He was so upset. He let it drop. His parents took him a number of hours to calm him down. Now, this was a very simple African-American family living out in the swamp areas. These people just don't, you know, they don't have any reason to start fictionalizing this stuff. And when that was reported to Sheriff Liston Truesdale out there, Liston went ahead and opened up an investigation into it because he had heard correlating reports being provided once the word got out from other people who had seen the same creature some weeks before. Since this event was so phenomenal that even Dan Rather was talking about it on the national news, and they were sending reporters out. It turned the place into an absolute zoo. We had people, people coming from out of town carrying shotguns through the swamp. We had individuals trying to dress up like Lizard Man in order to make it look like the whole thing was a hoax or something like that. Poor Liston was caught in a situation of saying, what do I do here? Because, you know, I've got people running around with shotguns,
yeah,
and people dressing up as lizard people. There's going to be some sort of an event here.
Yeah, someone's
going
to get blasted.
Right, and he was caught in a very difficult predicament. After that settled down a bit, there were continuing reports that came in of sightings of this creature from individuals who had no interest whatsoever in any kind of publicity, and some of these people were very, very high up in the
community,
the local community,
yeah,
down there in South Carolina. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman that was a full bird colonel, and he was getting ready to be promoted to Brigadier General in the U.S. Army. His name was Cooper, and he was driving back from a Baptist wedding rehearsal, which, of course, you know, there's no drinking now, so we're not talking about people who are just coming back from a party drunk. And he was in the car with his wife. They were driving down the road. She was dozing next to him, and he said that he came upon a creature that was running in front of his car and looking behind him, almost like a dog. You know how some dogs, you'd pass by a neighborhood and they'd chase your tire?
Yeah.
And it's not that they're mad at you, and this could be the same for Christopher Davis's case. It doesn't necessarily mean that the creature was mad at them.
It just wants to chase something.
But perhaps its mate was roadkill.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps it had something about vehicles, because in one other incident out there, there was a vehicle that was mauled outside somebody's house.
It just tore it apart?
Right, and it looks like a small animal was being hunted, and it may have tried to hide in the engine compartment of one of the large, older model cars, and something had literally reached around this vehicle and tore the siding off it, around the wheel,
yeah,
well, there's that strip of metal, and it had torn it off. Liston said when he got out there to look at it, he said, you know, myself and my deputy, he says, we pulled on that thing, and I mean, we put our feet up against the car and pulled on it. He said, we couldn't move that thing, so whatever did it had a tremendous amount of strength, and there were wires pulled out from the car. So when you're talking about creatures that may look aggressive in a situation, it doesn't we can't immediately assume this because we're frightened that we're the victim. It may, in these two cases, it looks like these something out there had an issue with cars. So when you start hearing about reports like that coming in from a man that's about to be promoted to brigadier general who just died this last year, and we have families. I mean, there's a case in which a woman was driving with her two children in the car, and they were laughing about the lizard man account. And they'd just come back from Baskin-Robbins, and they're driving along the same road, and because they hit that one area where it's historically known in that area as being the spot, they started laughing about it, and no sooner had they laughed about it when suddenly something jumped out in front of their car.
They didn't laugh anymore.
No, they came to a screeching halt, and apparently when these people said they looked out, she looked to the passenger side of the window where her daughter was, and she said all she could see was the width of this creature standing there, and it looked like it had fur. And when she stepped on it, and when the kids were looking back, they were commenting what it looked like, and she stopped the car, turned around and looked, and it was affirmed what her kids were saying was true, and they got the hell out of there. And, of course, all the reports were taken. And when you're seeing something, this is the whole thing down there. There were these mixed reports of this creature had hair, but we have to understand that we could be, just like mammals, there could be some advanced reptiles out there that may be flying ships around, but there could be some very wild ones as well.
Some plants that might have been stuck on them.
Right, or skins of animals used as disguise or even to keep warm.
Lizard man, Mothman, maybe one of the same?
Mothman, in my estimation, when I read, John Keel's great reports on it, it and hearing about the reptoids, especially the Draco that have been seen, if something was up in the air and the Draco did have wings, if its neck was drooped down as it was looking down at people and it had red glowing eyes, in the dark it would appear that the red glowing eyes are in the middle of its chest. It's very anomalous and unusual to hear about these reports of the Mothman, and they always place these eyes in the middle of the chest. Perhaps this creature was just looking down and the reflective eyes, like off a cat, were catching it, and this is what they were seeing. The reptilian contacts, when people have them, they often tend to have highly psychic events afterwards. And with Keel's reports down with Mothman events, there was a large amount of psychic activity taking place there with the bridge and, of course, the deaths of all those people.
Years ago, I interviewed a woman by the name of Pamela Stonebrook, who claims she's a musician, and she claims that she has had an ongoing love affair with a reptilian. Now, is she nuts, or what's going on?
I hear this a lot, and the only thing I can say is the reason that this has been promoted so much in recent years is because of sexationalization. In other words, they sexationalize it. When there's some titillating type of thing, excuse the pun, involved in these reports, people are more entertained by it. So, of course, there's more promotion of it. I do know that a number of years ago, these guys came out with this device where they could stimulate a woman's spine at the base of her spine and give her an orgasm just with vibration and frequency. And knowing this and knowing that there's a connection to the lower base of the spine, and the lower base of the spine is the lower chakra of the kundalini, when you have a being coming next to you like a tuning fork, if it's generating its atoms and molecules at a higher rate just by sympathetic resonance, which means like you strike a tuning fork and draw it close to another one, and the other one starts to resonate as well, when these creatures come within our vicinity, our atomic vibration, we become illuminated. Literally, we start releasing light, and we have a psychic activity. But as the tuning fork dulls down, the psychic activity starts to diminish with time.
Now, these abduction cases that so many people have talked about, where they think they see grays, are they also seeing these reptoids there?
The grays are disappearing into the shadows more and more now, and the reptoids are revealing their presence.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to, let me just finish this, when it comes to these people talking about sexual encounters with these beings, if you were sleeping in the middle of the night and you were a woman and something came within your presence into your room and it's vibrating at a higher rate, if your lower chakra starts getting generated, when you're asleep in a hypnagogic state, you're immediately thinking a sexual thing because you're being stimulated in that way because your chakra, your lower chakra, is starting to light up.
It's almost like what happens in sleep paralysis, I guess.
Just right. And in this case, because there's a sexual edge to it, where a sexual sensation of arousal being held, you believe that this person is actually penetrating.
So she may believe that this is really happening to her.
No, it could have really happened. And then afterwards, subsequent events either really did happen or, like in some of the captions of the images I put on your site over there, it's difficult for people to tell the real event from the not real event because usually after an encounter with these creatures, it stimulates them to be dreaming things. You know, the symbol of the serpent in the human mind in Jung psychiatry has always been one of stimulation of transformation. And when you have an event like that takes place, it's the natural image to start permeating from your hindbrain to your forebrain as trying to give a message of something. And the message is something may have happened, and also that reptilian is that reptilian that you're afraid of may be part of your own spiritual being as well. So there's the crossover.
You had mentioned earlier Childhood's End, which is the novel by Arthur C. Clarke, and I just mentioned a little bit about what that is. Well, what's the tie-in here with that?
Well, in 1952, we had the demonstration of air superiority over the White House. In 1953, we had the mass migration of U.S. military industrial corporate industries into the underground. We also had, like I said, the building of the NSA and such. But right at that time, 1953, within a year, Arthur C. Clarke writes the book Childhood's End, which talks about reptilian aliens, reptoids, reptilian humanoids. That's the correct term for these creatures. Reptilian could be anything. Even an alligator is a reptilian, but you have to be specific and say reptilian humanoid. He postulates in this book that these reptilian humanoids descended upon Earth, and, of course, Earth went into the stagnation after their presence. And it basically reflects on how a higher culture influences a lower culture, like anthropologists find out when they see how we interact with lesser, you know, intelligent peoples in deep Africa and stuff for the first time. The interesting thing about this is that if you read the front of Arthur C. Clarke's book, he makes the point out of writing in it, the opinions offered in this book are not those of the author. And I found that really fascinating.
That is
interesting. Thinking, you know, why
considering
would
him, because he never
why would
does that.
Write that. It doesn't make sense why he would write such a thing. Basically, saying that these ideas and opinions aren't mine, but I'm writing them. So it makes you wonder: is it possible that a lot of what we see in the media now is actually mixed with a lot of the truth, and that's the way to desensitize us to the possible event in the future? Because then, psychologically, we've already been there, done that, because we saw a movie.
That's fascinating all by itself.
Now, the connection, you were going to ask me about the connection between Arizona, Mexico, and England. Well, we've tied in, possibly, England and Mexico with the activity. But now the tie-in between Arizona and Mexico is this. A number of years ago, and this is an entirely different show, we could do it at a different time, I started investigating this thing about this lost city in the Grand Canyon that the Smithsonian Institution found in 1909. During my investigation of it, it's 15 years now that I've been studying it. When you look into the cultures of the Hopi Indians, they refer back to a time in which there were two beings that take them underground cyclically during times of great devastation, and they are the Ant people. Now you could say that's a gray, large head, large eyes, small limbs, lives underground, and then they had what they call their elder brothers, the snake people. And when I heard about this thing being found in the Grand Canyon, and I've actually, I even wrote a letter to the Smithsonian Institution asking questions, and they just blatantly sent me back a letter that they were caught lying even in their own letter to me, which was absolutely ridiculous. When you start looking at a mythology of a large underground city in the Grand Canyon, big enough for 50,000 people to live in, that was about 1,400 feet off the current level of the river, which in geological time, because of the erosion rate, would place it back at least 1.5 million years.
Hold it right there, John. We'll pick you right up when we come back. And we're going to take your phone calls right now on Coast to Coast. And our guest is John Rhodes. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM as soon as our equipment is ready. We'll just continue to chat for a while we can. John, let me go to you right now and chat with you for just a second while we can. Why don't you finish up on what you were talking about at the top?
Well, during the course of my investigation of this thing with the Grand Canyon and this large underground city that was found there, I had actually come into contact with the chief of Old Arabi Village on the Hopi Reservation. Now, the Old Arabi Village is the longest continually settled settlement in North America. Since the 1600s, the Hopi have been living there. And I just happened to meet him by chance when I was there and start talking to him, and we actually entertained a very lengthy relationship over the many years in which I spent many nights sitting by his side under the starlight in a dark house because he was blind at the time. No running water in there. It was very bare. And he would relate to me the things about the Hopis and the Navajos and the Serpent Brothers and about the history of his own people. He was, these gentlemen are called the Mongwis, so that means, you know, like chieftain. Since he's the chieftain of the oldest of all the villages, Hopi villages, technically he's chief of the Hopi. At this time, he's actually in an elderly home because he's incapacitated. But Chief Stanley was telling me about how the Serpent Brothers and the Ant People are going to be expected back, and even a lot of his own tribe out there have lost touch with these old beliefs. But the core of the elders that are there that have held tightly onto the ancient beliefs know that we're right on the cusp or event horizon of another cyclical devastation which will drive humanity possibly onto the brink of extinction, and that these Ant People or these Serpent Brothers are going to be making a reappearance. And when you tie that in with what's going on in Mexico City and the UFO activity over the Four Corners area of the United States, you can get a pretty decent picture, or at least a flavor, of what might be yet to come.
John, I've always been interested in the Hopi prophecy, and we'll be back. We'll open up the phone lines now at Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. John Rhodes, your phone call. John, before we go to the calls, David Icke believes that there is a reptilian bloodline with the power elite out there on this planet. Do you share his views?
A number of years ago, when I was talking about the subject matter, I was approached to contribute to some of the views of Mr. Icke, and I really decided not to because I knew that there was a conspiracy angle going into this, and I was really looking to try and look at this from a very objective viewpoint.
Okay.
I believe we're on the cusp of something very dangerous, and we got to be careful we don't turn into a witch hunt just by people saying, well, I saw him turn into a reptoid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and that can be very, very dangerous, and we've learned historically that we tend to get whipped up into a frenzy when thinking this way. And there's a lot of unsubstantiated reports of somebody saying that Bush turned into a reptoid, or the Queen turned, or they were sex slaves to these reptilian leaders. And I think, like, going back to this, it's an easy thing to do to take the ills of our own actions and place them onto another species who we have no idea other than beyond and above that they might exist. And we have to steer ourselves away from that. It can cause negative ramifications, fears. I've noticed it in very many people who have had abductions or are talking about this stuff. The fear generated by this subject matter can actually suppress your immune system and cause extreme stress in your physical body.
Fair enough.
There are negative things that can feed off that.
Okay, we go to the phones now. We'll pick it up by going to our West of the Rockies line. First, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. How are you this evening?
I'm doing fine.
Hi.
And where are you and who are you?
I'm Dee. I'm from Idaho.
Hi, Dee. Go ahead.
I was just going to comment on the video footage that Mr. Rhodes was talking about with the hundreds of objects flying over Mexico City. If that's the one I'm thinking of, it was done by Jaime Maussan, and he showed that in its entirety at the X conference this last April.
Wow.
There's some amazing footage on that. One of the objects that he showed was like a tube-shaped object, and Mr. Maussan said that they had estimated that there was roughly 20,000 objects came out of this tube-shaped thing.
Yeah, that's the one where it looked, appeared like it was a mothership and other vehicles or anomalous objects were actually detaching from it, flying around, and then reattaching to it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was amazing. There must have been at least 200 people in the room. And
well, they were gasping,
everybody
weren't they?
In, yeah, literally gasping.
Yeah, Jaime
well, years
a
ago,
job.
I approached Jaime, and I said, Jaime, this thing's going to come down to the reptilian image in your culture. And he was a little, this was before it was where, remember, years ago when I started, nobody was talking about this. I was just the odd person that was just trying to force the change of a turn in a river. And he was a little resistant to it. Now, however, he's changed his mind. There have been recent things that have occurred in Mexico that have actually drawn him to be more aware of a possibility of a serpent connection or something symbolically important of the serpent in what's happening now there.
If they took a poll of everyone in this country and you asked them if they believe that there were reptilians or reptoids living beneath the planet, what do you think the percent might be, one way or another, John?
A very small percent.
Would believe it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. You got to remember, I did this thing where I got onto the census site, and I Science Fiction Channel back in 2002 did a survey of like 1,200 people to find out, you know, what their feelings were about extraterrestrial life. It was being hidden and this, that, and the other. They estimated about 62% of Americans over the age of 18 believe that the government is not telling us the truth about extraterrestrial or other than human intelligences. Now, when you look at how many people are in America over the age of 18, that means there's 142 million Americans that say they're being lied to, but nationally, you're going to be lucky if you get 10 to 15,000 people that ever attend a conference.
That's
and it
true.
Just bewilders me. And I sometimes wonder if they don't look at those attendance records at the UFO conferences saying, well, they know by their own numbers and percentages that we're lying to them, but nobody really wants to go there and find out. So maybe they justify it thinking that the whole hiding of this whole thing is really a beneficial thing for us, when really it's just empowering and making richer and more powerful people who have entrenched themselves in controlling factors and positions in the world.
Of the people who have described what these creatures look like, did they talk about language or how they sound or how they communicate?
Well, sometimes you'll hear about grunts. Most of the time you're hearing about telepathic communications. One individual whose account I value highly had said that this creature appeared at his bed. There were other people sleeping in the house that actually opened their eyes and saw this creature walk past their sleeping bags on the floor when it was on its way to this other individual's bedroom. And it was staring at tunnel and underground cavern and possible base maps on the walls as if it was doing some sort of recon. The individual woke up, looked at the creature, threw a teddy bear through it, thinking it was going to just chase it away, and it didn't go. And this being just touched an instrument and then disappeared in front of him. So, where was I? I'm sorry.
Well, no, we were just talking about what kind of communication they had.
Oh, the communications, yes. When he was sitting there with this being in front of him, he said there was a point in which he looked, and there was some sort of a plasma type of a rotating matrix ball or something like this that came down from forward out of this reptilian, and actually he could feel it permeate his forehead and move into his brain. And he says that he was so overpowered by what had happened within, I think it was weeks or maybe a month or two afterwards, or even a couple of days, he felt that whatever this creature had imparted to him as far as wisdom and intelligence or whatever it was, he was acting upon it, because days later he went down and got a job at an optics lab for studying lasers. The guy said, "You got to test for this in 2 years in advance." He says, "No, I want the test now." He actually took the test, scored high grades, and went in there. And because he had no formal education in the technology, but he was demonstrating in the class that he had advanced knowledge of this, it was highly suspicious to the people, who thought that he may have been doing some espionage for somebody else. And he started thinking the same thing. So in other words, when you have a contact, it doesn't necessarily mean you're actually having a contact. There are instances of manipulation by these beings. And the ones that we're seeing if they're coming from an inner earth culture, we are not seeing their children. We are not seeing their artists. We are not seeing their parents. We're not seeing all the other subtle aspects of their culture. We're meeting their scientists. We're meeting their military personnel. We're meeting their security personnel, and these people are going to act more militarily, more militaristic, and more unemotional because they're of science, the detachment. And so those are the beings that we're meeting now.
Have we ever found any bones of these reptoids?
No, but when you're talking about a fossil record, you got to remember we find very few fossils anyway, and how many hundreds of millions of dinosaurs there were. So if you're talking to a very, very small population of these beings who are on surface erratically throughout history, then if they died, they could have had their bones interred or removed. People see elephants all the time, but we could never find what they were, where they were burying themselves. It's a big mystery.
I'm beginning to wonder if Sasquatch doesn't live beneath the planet somehow.
I have a feeling that not only Sasquatch and Reptoids, but other beings who are visitors and other inhabitants of former civilizations who had their chance on the surface of the Earth, who were afterwards became the aliens to the next Genesis culture, that those beings also live down there.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, hi, my name is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
It's all yours, Mike.
All right. I don't know. I just wanted to say, first of all, George, a picture show up about 3 weeks ago. I really enjoy it.
I'm glad you stumbled into us.
Since then, I drive a tractor at nighttime, and I haven't missed a show since I actually found it.
Perfect.
I just wanted to say, I guess I kind of look at things that I'm one of these people that if I can see it or touch it or whatever, it's real. And not to say that until, you know, I haven't seen something, it's not real, but it just seems kind of far-fetched to think that, you know, for instance, whether you're talking about, you know, the reptilianoids or, you know, aliens or whatever, it just seems strange to me that, you know, you always hear about alien abductions or the sightings and all that. And it seems to be that it's always like in the middle of the night while nobody's around, while there's maybe just a couple of witnesses,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Perfect time to do it.
Well, yeah. And you know, Mike, if you're thinking about beings that live underground, perhaps they once inhabited the surface. So really being underground, they feel trapped. And nighttime's the only safe time to really come out.
Yeah, I can understand that. But, you know, then again, you're saying that, you know, you've heard accounts of them wearing clothes and all. And I mean, if they're that smart and they've inhabited the Earth for so long and they're so far advanced and they're intelligent and all, I mean, and this goes for, you know, even aliens and so on, do you really think that they would be shy? I mean, would they even care? Or would,
well, you know what?
How do we know that they would even have those emotions anyway to feel that way to where they, you know, they can only expose themselves at night or around just a small group of people versus, you know, it just seems like for years and years you hear about these things, but yet you never, you know, it's not something you turn on CNN and hear, boom, here's the proof of it.
Yeah, but if you heard that, can you imagine the psychological impact on the world? Can you imagine how many people that decide, I'm not going to go to work tomorrow? Can you imagine how many people would take their money out of the bank account because they saw War of the Worlds or they heard about it and now they're a little afraid maybe they want to go build a bunker of themselves and kind of get their family out of the cities? It would disrupt human society to such a degree, as the Brookings Report said, that unless we're desensitized beforehand, we'll never get past that psychological impact. The thing that worries me most is that, you know, we might be actually seeing a culture or a species being set up for some sort of eventual conflict with humanity. Ronald Reagan in his 1988 disarmament mm-hmm. speech to the United Nations, the General Assembly speech, when he talked about the extraterrestrial threat, and many people have heard about this. If you go to my website, actually, I have an audio link on there where you can hear it. One of the interesting things is that when you read his notes from his drafts, Ronald Reagan's own handwriting, which is on the site, you can see it, where he talks to his Rhett Butler, who is a speechwriter, and he says, I want to make sure that you put my alien fantasy, and he used fantasy in his quote marks, back into this draft, this speech. In other words, he had said it, he had written it, he had sent it off to speechwriters, they took it out. And then he had to tell them, go put it back in. And when they put it back in, it's a strange thing to notice that not only in the quote marks was his words were so tight and almost scrambled when he wrote the word fantasy, and any handwriting analysis person was going to say this person had a trouble thinking this was a fantasy.
Well, I know I know the late president's son, Michael, and he was telling me a couple of years ago that his dad believed in an extraterrestrial presence out there. And
I believe
and
that
I
he
think
did.
Had seen a UFO near his ranch in,
right.
here
and
in California.
The interesting thing about this handwritten note, Mike, was that when you look above where he had written this reminder, he had actually done a three-pointed zigzag sign, which historically has always been associated with the symbol of the serpent.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Bruce, calling from Brooklyn.
Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Bruce.
How are you? And first of all, George, I'd just like to say you've done an excellent job with Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you.
Really great, great thing you've got. I was reading a one of the Zachariah Sitchin Earth Chronicles books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure which one it was, but he published a picture, which I think came from ancient Mesopotamia, and it depicted two reptoids who
right.
were dressed, and they were holding up a caduceus, sort of like a coat of arms type of picture. And I was just wondering, where does the caduceus come from? I mean, it seems like it's definitely related to reptilians, and it seems like an ancient symbol that goes back a long way. What do you know about it?
The symbol of the caduceus, when you're looking at the caduceus, you're looking at the human spine and the entwined serpents, or the positive and negative polarity of energy that slips up the spine. The staff at the top, or the ball, is generally perceived as being the pineal gland of the human body. When there's wings extended from the ball, this is associated with the balance of serpent and feather. If you look back through history, you're going to see two symbols emerge most prominently in ancient religions, the bird and the feather. Okay, and now you have, in India, you have the Nagas, which are the semi-divine reptilian humanoid beings, and then their enemies are the Garuda bird. Now, here's a serpent versus a bird. In other cultures, you see the same symbolic balance. You see in the United States, our first flag was a serpent. In Mexico City, they have a flag with an eagle with a serpent in its mouth. So here you have this balanced image of reptile and feather. In even Christianity, you have reptilians or reptoids, which are supposedly the physical example of evil, or the devil in the Garden of Eden, or this lizard in the Garden of Eden. And then you have the others, which are the angels, which are humanoid beings with feathers again, which are birds. So you have this balanced thing that you see all throughout history in all these different cultures. And even with the dragon, you're seeing something that's reptilian, yet at the same time it has wings. With the caduceus, you're talking about Aesculapius, which was in ancient Rome, the healer, the great healer. He was associated with serpents. They had Aesculapia, which were these sacred areas in which they healed people. And the only way to heal people was to have them sleep overnight in the temple. And the temple had snakes in the temple. And the brotherhood of Aesculapius was also one which they taught their healing methods and such to their children, and it was an inherited thing. Now, that's why, and even in modern medicine, you have the serpent entwined around the staff, and you see this on hospital ambulances and such like that. So there's this association with healing. There's also the hermetic associations with communication and commerce, which is a different thing altogether, which is a single staff with the snake entwined around it as well.
All right, to stay with us for final phone calls with our guest John Rhodes tonight on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about these reptoids. I'll tell you, these pictures that John supplied us that you'll find on the coasttocoastam.com website that come from his website, reptoids.com, these things are very strange-looking creatures. I'll tell you that. To see something of that kind of magnitude, scope, size, staring at you. Look at the one, by the way, when you go into the image section, look at the last one down there, Night Visit. And just look at the way this thing's peering down on this poor woman. Back in a moment with your calls. John, do you think Admiral Richard Byrd, when he flew into the hole, might have seen a reptoid or two?
Wow. That's a good question. You know, yeah. May have looked like ants to him at that distance.
Could have been, yeah. He saw something.
I thought he just saw ants. Look,
he did see a mastodon, I think.
Pardon me?
When he was flying in, I think he did see a mastodon.
Yeah, I've heard rumors to that effect. Yeah. You know, but of course, we're getting back to the bird diaries again and the authenticity of the bird diaries.
True.
You know?
Yeah, but who would fake that?
Well, there's people, you know, that's one of the things I was, when I first started bringing this out to the public's attention about the reptoids, you know, it was hard enough already, and I was talking about such a controversial and volatile subject. I've had strange reactions from people all over the world. But one of the things that led to my dropping out was, I couldn't help but look through the some of these people's reports and what they were saying was so transparent, especially people even in the UFO community that was kind of a little bit disillusioned with it, because in the very beginning when I was studying the subject, very, very few people were talking about it. There were very few movies on television stuff that were already bringing this out. The information was more raw. It was more real. Now you have an increase in numbers of reports, but a certain percentage of them are going to be because people just fictionalize things. And it's just human nature. And it's forgiving, but at the same time, I don't want to waste my time. I have to get on the next thing.
All right, and on we go. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hello.
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 I'm on the line.
Yeah, you are. Can you hear us?
Okay. My name's Bonnie. I'm calling from San Diego.
Go ahead.
Hi, Bonnie.
I would like to know, I'm new to the show, okay?
Okay.
But I have friends that have listened to you, and all my friends are Rh negative, and so am I, and my family. And we're curious. Do you and your guests believe all Rh negatives to be reptilians?
Well, I can't comment on that, but John, that's all for you.
Yeah, well, I think I heard Louis Turney the other day say, George, that you were ruled by the head of the dragon.
Yes.
You know, as far as astronomically.
That.
And I thought, you know, if you're not Rh negative, you got something going for you there.
No, I'm O positive, but I wonder if he's accusing me of being a reptoid.
Ah, well, there wouldn't be anything wrong with that. I myself am Rh negative.
Oh, good.
The Rh negative factor, for those people that don't know what Rh even means, it means rhesus. And it, basically, there was a mutation of unknown origin that actually occurred between 23 and 25,000 years ago.
Correct.
To the human species. And people who test positive for, in other words, they have a positive blood type, means they tested positive and show an indication of this mutation. People who test negative means it shows that there is no mutation. Now, an original has to be altered, so it means that actually the people who are Rh negatives are part of some select group or small population that was separated by everybody else because the mutation occurred, but they just weren't in the same spot. The Rh negative blood factor has been addressed by Rod Steiger at length, colleagues of my own and myself. We look back and the Rh factor people, about 5% of the world have Rh negative blood. There's higher concentrations, up to 15% in England. In Norway and Scotland, there's heavier concentrations of where the Celts were. These were people that were generally red-haired with green eyes, or brown or black hair with dark brown eyes. These are individuals who, in the very beginning, when we started getting past the Space Brother thing and into the Greys, they started knowing an anomalous increase in reports from people who had Rh-negative blood having being abducted and having contacts or sightings. And if you follow the Rh concentration back like Kalspar Spori did in his genetic population studies, they say the Basque region, which is the area between France and Spain, was the heaviest concentration. As a matter of fact, they said about at one time 100% of all the people of that Basque region were Rh negative. The Rh negs, the whole serpent connection to this is, and I'm going about this to get you there, is that if there was an older population in an area of where the Neanderthals were last, if some sort of experimentation happened at a long, long time ago, it may have happened to the offspring of these very ancient man, and therefore their offspring and their descendants are the carriers of genetic information that was planted there a long time ago by the reptoids' ancestors when the experiments first began. It's like a genealogical hall of records in your DNA. There is information in your DNA, and sometimes it's been in the UFO community or in my studies, I can tell you that I believe that information is being put into some people with Rh negative blood, and it comes through as intuition and driving intuitive forces in that person's mind. And these people start acting and doing things. Now, are they doing it of their own accord, or are they being driven to do this by something genetically, altered in them? So, no, not everybody's reptilian, but there's a strong degree of possibility that the people with the Rh negative blood are actually at risk of being part of this witch hunt, because if people start taking off after reptoids or reptilians and they get frightened of it, then people with Rh negative blood have to be careful of not being victims to another mass panic.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. Thanks for that, by the way. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, this is Blake. I'm in basically Toledo, Ohio.
Hey, Blake.
Just want to say hi to John.
Hello, sir.
Hi to you, definitely, George. We've been listening to your show for almost a year. It is, we set our clocks to the time. I mean, we don't miss it for nothing.
Great.
But last time I talked to you, was during the mad cow disease show that you had on.
Yeah, that was a while back. Yeah,
it's been a while. But my question to John was kind of with our religion and stuff, because I believe that there was and still is dragons that exist just on another plane is the way I've always seen it. But now, from what he was saying about taking the stories that we've heard and turn them upside down, if they don't actually exist underground, and what his thought is between the dragon species and the species that he's talking about.
Reptoids, yeah.
Yeah, reptoids. What do you feel on that? And if they live underground, if they might have something to do with the dragon ley line.
Well, when you're talking about, dragons, you're talking about symbols, merged symbols of birds and serpent. The dragons at one time, when you look back at the fossil record, you know that there were large, dinosaur creatures or pterodactyls flying around. So there could have been animals that were actually dragons, but these were perhaps animals like a wise old elephant, something that's so wise and graceful in appearance that people were just enamored with them, that were killed off at one time a long time ago, because, we love to kill things, us humans, even if it means there's no more of them left, especially if it means there's going to be no more of them left, and that these creatures may have been pursued by the local and cultures a long time ago. A lot of the dragon mythology is more of a symbolic language. It's one of transformation and overcoming that evil or dark reptilian side of yourself. We all have some sort of power inside us that we can grasp if we look at it. But it's like it's like a razor. It'll cut you if you're not careful with it. So I do believe that maybe dragons and creatures like that existed at one time. At this point, unless it's being done in some hidden niche that we're not aware of yet, like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, alluded to on some lost culture underground, the same thing with Dinotopia, all these television shows, even Dan Aykroyd has a television a script under his arm about reptoids. So, and he's the MUFON media representative. So when you have all these symbols merged towards now, it's really interesting that you ask this great question, because when you're looking forward to 2012, you're looking forward at a time, even in the Chinese calendar, where it's the year of the serpent or the year of the dragon, and it transforms into the year of the snake in 2013.
Very good. Thanks for that question, Blake. Appreciate it. Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
This is Matt. I'm on there.
Yep, you sure are.
All right. Hi, George. Hi, John.
Hello.
All right, I wanted to get through last night, but I guess you guys didn't have enough time. This question was for Nick, but also relates to tonight's show as well. John, have you found throughout any of your research that our government or a government or many governments or all governments, I don't know which, are going to stage a mass alien invasion, but it's actually going to be fake? And that they've been conditioning us, like with alien movies like War of the Worlds and Independence Day and stuff like that, to fear them, so they can unify the world into a one government type of world.
Yeah, that's part of what I wrote a little bit. I addressed that a little bit on my site when I showed the handwritten note of Ronald Reagan with his serpent symbol he wrote above it. I don't think that they're going to have to fake anything. You know,
you think it's going to be a real invasion?
Arthur C. Clarke alluded to this when he talked right after the White House event happened, when he released the book Childhood's End, and he said, these aren't my ideas. I think that eventually we're going to be brought to a point of where a real conflict does happen. Now, there have been a lot of persistent talk about an approaching contingent force of alien reptoids who may have left Earth a long time ago to travel the universe and are now coming back. And the ones here, do they want these guys coming back and kicking them out of their positions of power? Are they bad? If they tell us they're bad, are they bad? You know, so this is where they say even in the Bible, the elect will be deceived, because your leaders may tell you one thing, but we've been lied to before.
What are the next things you do as a crypto hunter,
John? I'm taking off across the United States for 2 years, going on the road and traveling around and doing DVD road logs of people who have had encounters across the United States.
How are you going to find them? Or they find you?
They're going to find me, because I'm going to be going out to their areas, and I'm going to be – our website is going to be tracking this all along. It's going to be thecryptohunter.com, C-R-Y-P-T-O, hunter.com. In other words, I hunt all secrets. I'm a researcher of secrets. And I'll be coming out to your hometown near you. And if you hear or see of me in the area and you want somebody to look into your
look
at your evidence and hear your story, just call me.
They see you coming, something's going on, huh?
Well, if they see me coming, better look behind my shoulder, make sure I'm not running, because if I am, they better head in the same direction at full pace.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, is this me?
Yes, sir.
Hi, I was wondering, I'd like to ask John about the hole in the ground and the effects of gravity in there.
Now, you're talking about the hollow hole in the poles, or
yeah,
the Mel's hole that Art was talking about years ago?
I'm not sure. Whichever one it was that, like, sloped down.
Yeah, if you're talking about a possible entrance that's 800 miles in circumference at the polar regions, we've got to remember that gravity is an attraction of mass, and even though there's curved ground under your feet, your mass is still going to be attracted towards the center. Even if the Earth was hollow, the actual middle ground between the hollow area and the outer area would have its heaviest density of matter and attraction. So even if you were on the inside of the planet, you would be attracted towards the outside of the shell. Number one, centrifuge will play a part in it. And number two, the attraction of mass.
And listen to this, John. This will interest you in terms of areas on this planet, and I won't read them all, but I'll just mention the ones here in the United States, where they believe there's entrance to the center of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Kentucky on the Monmouth Cave in south central Kentucky. Mount Shasta in California. There's supposed to be an opening there.
Yep. Reptoids have been seen there.
Then that's it. That's it in this country. The rest are in Argentina, Brazil, some in China, Italy, but just the one in Kentucky and the one in California. That's it for the entrances.
Well, we're talking about possible entrances, but, you know, there are probably many more that we're unaware of.
Oh, sure.
You know, 1/2000th of the Earth's surface is actually porous enough to have an opening into the underworld.
What would you do if you saw a reptoid came right up to you?
You know, I've been wondering that, like my joke, you know, if you see me running in your direction,
yeah,
you'll be heading in the same direction.
I don't know. You just might be in shock that you saw one. You may just stand there.
Well, you know, the thing is that the first thing, if anybody encounters one of these creatures, is to stand dead still. You don't want to raise your arms, because that may be provoking a signal of attack.
Mm-hmm.
You want to keep your palms upwards and open so they can see you're not holding anything. I wouldn't approach it, because reptiles have a keen sense of smell.
And these are intelligent beings, though, right?
These are intelligent beings.
Okay.
You know, hey, if we're – even if something's wild, even if something was wild, the last thing you should do is run.
Well,
because you'll be attacked. It's because if it is a wild creature, even if it's not a reptoid, if it's a wild creature and you start running, the game's over.
What do they eat?
I don't know. You know.
Don't tell me.
No, I won't tell you. John Lear, I have an interview with him on a video that I've got coming up. He doesn't do very many interviews, because he was kind of attacked for even touching upon this reptilian stuff in the very beginning. And his private office is covered with dragons. He got attacked for mentioning that there was rumors that they would be eating people. But, you know, there's a lot of the hype again.
Yeah.
You know, you're just repeating what you've heard.
The fear factor.
But a lot of the food sources from our food chain up here. Now, we know that there's a lot of surplus foods in the world that are supposedly shipped out to other nations, but we have no telling if that freight car or that truck actually made it overseas. It could have just very well have gone into some sort of a hangar or docking station and disappeared. Now, there have been many reports of people saying they've seen commerce traffic going into airport hangars and then just suddenly disappearing when the hangar doors open up again, which means it's going underground. So they may be actually supplementing their food system with food items that we're negotiating through treaties to send down there while they deliver us technology, as per, you know, the reports that have come out recently, you know, even with the crone.
Can these creatures morph into other things?
That's a good question. I mean, we know that there's chameleons, and the reptilian form through history has always shown that it's very adaptive.
That's right.
They can change their skin color.
That's right.
You know, they can change their shape. We've recently found a jellyfish in the deep oceans that can actually change its shape into 8 other forms of fishes. So the profile actually looks like it's something that was not going to be scrumptious to the predator that just came by.
Let's go to our final first-time caller. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Paul from Rhode Island. How you doing?
Good, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, Paul.
Well, I just want to say I love your show. I actually came across your show while looking for something intelligent and, you know, intellectually stimulating to listen to while I got a new job.
Oh, thanks. That's a compliment.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. I have a couple of quick comments to make about things I've heard throughout the night. You may be, hi, John, by the way.
Oh, hi.
I heard you make a comment about, saying when Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, you said that it's possible that the garden may have been underground due to, the Bible saying that they saw the light. Well, I took a look and it said that, didn't make any mention of them, of it seeing the light, it said that they were kicked out of the garden and an angel was posted east side with a flaming sword. Also, you're talking about our revelation with the dragon. One thing about Revelation you got to keep in mind is that Revelation is full of symbolism. So
Absolutely.
It's all about symbolism. The clock's got us, John Rhodes. I want to thank you for being a very special guest on Coast to Coast.
Thank you very much, George. I really appreciated being on, and I'm really happy to be back in touch with everybody out there and knowing that everybody is about to launch off into a new horizon. Be careful. Watch out. There's reptoids all around us and all under our feet.
John Rhodes, reptoids.com. For Steve Carr, Nikki Imbrunoni, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, and Sean LaDesure, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, this list gets longer. Be safe, everyone.